6 years to go.
Tunde. Tatiana Moskalev was right, and she'd given him good information. He spent 2 months investigating in the hills of northern Moldova, or the country that used to be Moldova and is currently at war with the southern part of itself, carefully questioning and bribing the people he met there. Reuters footed his bill on this occasion. He told an editor he trusted about the tip he'd got, and she signed off his costs. If he found it, it would be the biggest kind of news. If he didn't find it, he'd be able to do a portrait of this war-torn country, and that'd give them something at least. But he found it. One afternoon, a man in a village near the border agreed to drive Tunde in his jeep to a place on the river Dniester, with a view down into the valley. There, they saw a compound hastily thrown up, with low-slung buildings and a central training yard. The man would not let Tunde leave the jeep, and he wouldn't drive any closer. But they had a good enough view for Tunde to take 6 photographs. They showed brown-skinned men with beards in battle fatigues and black berets, training with a new weapon, new armour. Their bodysuits were made of rubber. On their backs they wore battery packs, and in their hands they carried electric cattle prods. It was only 6 photographs, but it was enough. Tunde had made world news. "A Wadi Atif trained secret army," was the Reuters headline. Others shouted, "The boys are back," and "Look who's shocking." There were anxious debates in newsrooms and on morning shows about the implications of these new weapons. Could they work? Would they win? Tunde hadn't managed to photograph King Awadi Atif himself, but the conclusion that he was working with the Moldovan Defence Forces was unavoidable. The situation had begun to stabilise in many countries, but this news kicked it off again. Perhaps the men were coming back, with their weapons and armour. In Delhi, the riot went on for weeks. It began in the places under the motorway bridges, where the poor people live in blanket tents or houses constructed from cardboard and tape. This is the place men come when they want a woman they can use without law or licence, discard without censure. The power has been passed from palm to palm here for 3 years now. And the many death-bearing hands of women have a name here. Kali, the Eternal. Kali, who destroys to bring fresh growth. Kali, intoxicated by the blood of the slain. Kali, who puts out the stars with her thumb and forefinger. Terror is her name, and death is her breathing in and out. Her arrival in this world has been long expected. Any adjustment in understanding had come easily to the women under the motorway bridges of the megacity. The government sent in the army. The women of Delhi discovered a new trick. A jet of water, directed at the attacking forces, could be electrified. The women put their hands into the spouts and sent death from their fingers, like the goddess walking the earth. The government cut off the water supply to the slum neighbourhoods in the highest heat of the summer, when the streets stink of rot and the pregnant dogs wander, panting, in search of shelter from the sun. The world's media filmed the poor begging for water, praying for a single drop. And on the third day, the heavens opened and sent an unseasonal rainstorm, hectic and thorough as a scouring brush, washing the smell from the streets and collecting in puddles and pools. When the soldiers return, they are standing in the wet, or touching wet rails, or their vehicles are trailing some loose wire into the wet. And when the women light up the roadways, people die quite suddenly, falling to the ground frothing, as though Kali herself had struck them down. The temples to Kali are full of worshippers. There are soldiers who join with the rioters, and Tunde is there too, with his cameras and his CNN pass. In the hotel filled with foreign journalists, people know him. He's seen some of these reporters before, in other places where justice is at last being meted out, although it's not considered good form to say so. Officially in the West, the thing is still a crisis, with all the word implies: exceptional, deplorable, temporary. The team from Allgemeine Zeitung Greet him by name, congratulate him, with a slightly envious tone, on the scoop of the 6 photographs of Awad Atif's forces. He's met the more senior editors and producers from CNN, even a team from the Daily Times of Nigeria, who ask him where he's been hiding and how they could have missed him. Tunde has his own YouTube channel now, broadcasting footage from around the world. His face begins each broadcast. He is the one who goes to the most dangerous places to bring the images no one else will show. He celebrated his 26th birthday on a plane. One of the air stewards recognized his face and brought him champagne. In Delhi, he follows behind a pack of women rampaging through Janpath Market. There was a time that a woman could not walk alone here, not if she were under 70, and not with certainty even then. There had been protests for many years, and placards and shouted slogans. These things rise up, and afterwards it is as if it had never been. Now, the women are making what they call a show of force, in solidarity with those who were killed under the bridges and starved of water. Tunde interviews a woman in the crowd. She had been here for the protests 3 years earlier. Yes, she had held up her banner and shouted and signed her petitions. "It was like being a part of a wave of water," she says. "A wave of spray from the ocean feels powerful, but it is only there for a moment. The sun dries the puddles and the water is gone. Then you feel maybe it never happened. That is how it was with us. The only wave that changes anything is a tsunami. You have to tear down the houses and destroy the land if you want to be sure no one will forget you." He knows exactly where this part will fit in his book. The history of political movements. The struggle that moved so slowly until this great change happened. He's putting together an argument. There is little violence against people. Mostly, they are turning over stalls.
"Now they will know," shouts one woman into Tunde's camera, "that they are the ones who should not walk out of their houses alone at night. They are the ones who should be afraid."
There is a brief scuffle when 4 men with knives appear in the crowd, but this is quickly dealt with, leaving the men with twitching arms, but no permanent injuries. He has started to suspect that there will be nothing new here today, nothing that hasn't been seen before, when the word comes through the crowd that the army have formed a barricade up ahead, across Windsor Place. They are trying to protect the foreign hotels. They're advancing slowly, armed with rubber bullets and shoes with thick, insulating soles. They want to make a demonstration here, a show of force to let the world see how a properly trained army deals with a rabble like this. Tunde doesn't really know any of the women in this crowd. There is no one who would shelter him in her home if the army came. The crowd is becoming more tightly pressed together. It has happened so gradually, he barely noticed it. But it makes sense, now he knows that the army is trying to squeeze them all into one place. And then what will happen? People will die here today. He feels it up his spine and into the crown of his head. There are shouts from up ahead. He doesn't speak enough of the language to understand. Tunde's usual mild smile fades from his face. He has to get away from here. Has to find high ground. He looks around. Delhi is constantly under construction, most of it unsafe. There are buildings from which the scaffolding has never been removed, shop fronts that slant awkwardly, even some half-collapsed places still partly inhabited. There, 2 streets up. There's a boarded-up shop behind a wagon selling parathas. A kind of wood scaffolding is fixed to the side of the building. The roof is flat. He shoulders his way through the crowd urgently. Most of the women are still trying to move forward, shouting and waving their banners. There's the hiss and crackle of electrical discharge somewhere further ahead. He can feel it in the air now. He knows what it feels like. The scents of the street, the dog shit and the mango pickle, and the body odour of the crowd and the frying bindi with cardamom become more intense for a moment. Everyone pauses. Tunde pushes forward still. He says to himself, "This is not the day you die, Tunde. This is not that day. It'll be a funny story to tell your friends back home. It'll go into the book. Don't be afraid." Just keep moving. You'll get good footage from a high vantage point if you can just find a way up there. The lowest hanging piece of scaffold is a little too high for him to reach, even by jumping. Further up the street, he sees that other people have had the same idea, are climbing onto the roofs or into the trees. Some others are trying to pull them down. If he doesn't get up there now, he could be overwhelmed in a few minutes by others trying to take his place. He yanks over three old fruit boxes, piles them on top of each other, takes a long splinter in his thumb as he does it but doesn't care, climbs on top of the boxes and leaps. Misses, comes down heavily, the shock sending a jolt of pain through his knees. These boxes won't last. The crowd is surging and chanting again. He jumps again, this time with more force, and there, he's got it. Bottom rung of the scaffold ladder. Straining the muscles in his sides, he hauls himself up to the second rung, the third, and then he can scramble his feet up onto the rickety structure, and then it's easy. The scaffold sways as he climbs. It's not bolted to the walls of this crumbling concrete building. It was lashed with ropes once, but they frayed and rotted, and the strain of his climbing is pulling the fibres apart. Now this would be a stupid way to die. Not in a riot, not by an army bullet, not by Tatiana Moskalev taking him by the throat. Just falling a dozen feet onto his back on a street in Delhi. He climbs faster, reaching the rough parapet as the whole structure sighs and swings more wildly from side to side. He clings to the parapet with one arm, feeling that splinter working its way into his thumb, kicks off with his legs and manages to jump half onto the roof so that his right arm and right leg are wrapped around the parapet and his body is swinging above the street. There are screams from further along the street and pops of gunfire. He pushes again with his left leg, just giving himself enough momentum to flop backward onto the gravel roof of the building. He lands in a puddle, soaking him through to the skin. But he's safe. He hears the creak and crack as the whole wooden structure finally gives up and crashes to the ground. That's it, Tunde. No way back down. On the other hand, no chance of being overwhelmed by crowds escaping the crush up here. Actually, it's perfect. Like it was meant to work out this way for him. He smiles, breathes out slowly. He can set up his camera here, film the whole thing. He's not afraid anymore. He's excited. There's nothing he could do anyway. No authorities to call and no boss to check in with. Just him and his cameras. Up here, out of the way. And something's going to happen. He sits up and looks around. And it's then he sees there's a woman there, with him, on the rooftop. She's in her mid-40s, wiry with small hands and a long, thick plait like an oiled rope. She's looking at him. Or not quite at him. She flicks him glances, looks to the side. He smiles, she smiles back. And in that smile, he can tell with certainty that there's something wrong with her. It's the way she's holding her head to the side, the way she's not looking at him and then suddenly staring at him. Are you? He looks down at the surging crowd in the street. There's the sound of gunfire, nearer now. Sorry, if this is your place. I'm just waiting here till it's safe to go down. That all right? She nods, slowly. He tries a smile. Not looking good down there. You come up here to hide? She speaks slowly and carefully. Her accent's not bad. She could be saner than he thought. I was looking for you. He thinks for a moment she means that she knows his voice from the internet, that she has seen his photograph. He half smiles, a fan. She kneels down, dabbles her fingers in the puddle of water he's still sitting in. He thinks she's trying to wash her hands until the shock hits his shoulder and his whole body begins to tremble. It's so sudden and so quick that for a moment he imagines it must have been a mistake. She's not meeting his eyes, she's looking away. The pain bleeds across his back and down his legs. There are scribbles of pain drawing a tree across his side. It's hard to breathe. He's on his hands and knees. He has to get out of the water. He says, "Stop! Don't do that!" His own voice surprises him. It's petulant, pleading. He sounds like someone more afraid than he feels himself to be. It's going to be fine. He's going to get away. He starts to back up. Beneath them, the crowd is yelling. There are screams. If he can just make her stop this, he'll get some amazing shots of the street, the fighting. The woman still stirring the water with her fingers. Her eyes are rolling in her head. He says, "I'm not here to hurt you. It's okay. We can just wait up here together." She laughs then. Several barks of laughter. He rolls over, crawls backwards out of the pool of water, watches her. Now he's afraid. It was the laughing that did it. She smiles, a bad, wide smile. Her lips are wet. He tries to stand up, but his legs are shaking, and he can't quite manage it. He collapses onto one knee. She watches him, nodding, like she's thinking, "Yes, this is expected. Yes, this is the way it goes." He looks around the rooftop. There's not much. There's a rickety bridge across to another roof. Just a plank. He wouldn't like to cross it. She could kick it over as he walked. But if he grabbed it, he could use it as a weapon, fend her off at least. He starts to crawl towards it. She says a few words in a language he doesn't know, then very quietly, "Are we in love?" She licks her lips. He can see her skein twitching at her collarbone, a living worm. He moves faster. He is faintly aware that there are other people watching them from the rooftop across the road, people pointing and calling out. There's not much they can do from there. Maybe video it? How much good will that do him? He tries standing again, but his legs are still trembling from the aftershocks, and she laughs when she sees him try. She lunges for him. He tries to kick her in the face with his shoe, but she grabs the exposed ankle and gets him again. A long, high arc. It feels like a meat cleaver wielded in a solid and practiced stroke all down his thigh and calf, separating the flesh from the bone. He can smell the hair on his legs burning. There is a scent, like spices, something wafting up from the street, roasting meat and the smoke of dripping animal fats and burned bones. He thinks of his mother, reaching into the pot to test the grains of parboiled rice between her fingertips. "Too hot for you, Tunde. Get your hands away." He can smell the sweet hot aroma of the jollof rice bubbling on the stove. "Your brain is jangled, Tunde. Remember what they say about this. Your mind is made of meat and electrics. This thing hurts more than it should because it short-circuits your brain. You are confused. You are not at home. Your mother will not come." She has him on the ground now. She is wrestling with his belt and his jeans. She's trying to pull them down without undoing the buckle, and they're too tight to come over his hips. His back is scraping on the gravel. He can feel the edge of a wet concrete block in the small of his back, rubbing him raw, and he keeps thinking, if I fight her off too hard, she'll knock me unconscious, and then she can do whatever she wants. There is shouting now from far off, as if he were underwater, his ears clogged. At first he thinks he is hearing the shouting from the street. He is ready for another shock. His body is tensed for it, and it is only when the shock does not come, when he realizes he is fighting with the air, that he opens his eyes and sees that three other women have pulled her off him. They must have crossed on the plank bridge from the building next door. They have thrown her down, and they are shocking her time and again, but she will not lie still. Tunde pulls his trousers back up and waits, watching until that woman with her long, thick, oiled plait has stopped moving altogether.